This is the Concealed Carry Podcast, episode number 74. Welcome to the Concealed Carry Podcast, part of the USA Firearm Training Network. I am your host, Riley Bowman.
Riley, the man who pretty much finished all of his holiday shopping between Thanksgiving and Cyber Monday. Impressive.
Thank you. And by the way, this is a different voice than usual, folks. So who do we have with us today?
I'm Matthew Marister.
And Matthew is the guy who wears shorts and a t-shirt in the winter and refuses to admit he is freezing.
Yep, that's me. I'm that guy.
I think that's just the Marine in you. Would a Marine ever admit they're freezing?
No, you can't. You can't show weakness.
That's right. So, folks, if you're a longtime listener, you've heard Matthew on the program with us before, and I'm so glad to have him on again. And so today we are going to be talking about, well, here's the title of the episode, Now What? Dealing with the Gun After It's Been Used. So specifically, we'll be talking a little bit about reholstering or similar things. So I look forward to getting into this with you today, Matthew. But first, as is customary on this podcast, today in history. So today being, by the way, November 30th. Now, we were actually recording this on November 29th, but you folks are listening to it on the 30th. So on November 30th in 1874, Winston Churchill was born.
Wow.
Yeah. Long time, prime minister during the World War II, or the Second Great War, which, you know, he was responsible really a lot for the morale and inspiration behind the fight that the Brits were able to put up, against the evil axis of power. Also on this day in 1835, another famous person was born, and this one was Samuel Clemens, also known as Mark Twain. So, and I'm a fan of Mark Twain and his writings, a very witty, clever author and writer. So thought some of you listeners would find pleasure in knowing that today is his birthday. So happy birthday to Mark Twain and Winston Churchill. And also today is the birth date of the Brady Bill being signed into law in 1993. Nice. So this certainly has application to this podcast and what we talk about, Matthew.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, I mean, for those that don't know or recall or are not familiar with the Brady Bill, this was the bill that was able to get, you know, passed into law under President Clinton and a Democrat-controlled Congress, which that later switched the next election cycle. But they were able to get this passed through, and it required a couple of things: background checks on handgun purchases, and actually it required a 5 business day wait. Right. Now that has since, you know, gone away. And also the assault weapons ban was also kind of a part of this and was inspired by a lot of this. I mean, this was all, you know, the Brady campaign, you know, was pushing all these laws and bills through. And they had a reliable friend in Bill Clinton in the White House at the time. And also on this day in history, 1954, I thought this one was interesting. And this is just more random. Like, some of you might just get a kick out of this. In 1954 in Alabama, a meteorite struck a woman.
Ouch.
Yeah, it's one of the first modern instances, or one of the first instances that we, I guess, are aware of and kind of know what happened, I would guess, you know, so it's in the history books. A meteorite, this is a sulfide meteorite. It weighed about 8.5 pounds, measured 7 inches long, and it crashed through the roof of her house into the living room, bounced off a radio, and struck her on the hip. And
wow.
She was the woman, Elizabeth Hodges, was asleep on the couch at the time of impact. And she was not permanently injured, but suffered a nasty bruise along her hip and leg. That's crazy.
Yeah, imagine if it just wouldn't have gone through the roof and deflected off it, if it just would have hit her straight on. I mean,
yeah, no kidding.
I don't think he survived that.
Yeah, and actually it says here, ancient Chinese records tell of people being injured or killed by falling meteorites.
Wow. Hmm.
But this was in, I'm going to get totally, I know, murdered via email and Facebook messages as soon as I try to pronounce this. Sylacauga?
Sounds terrific.
Sylacauga, Alabama. I'm sorry, I've never been there, never even heard of it. they refer to this as the Sylacauga meteorite, which is the first modern record of this type of human injury. But in 1911, a dog in Egypt was killed by the Nakhla meteorite. Uh-huh. Okay. All right.
Wow.
Watch out for those meteorites, folks. So anyway, Matthew, once again, thanks for joining me here today.
Oh, man.
Let's start transitioning now into our topic for today. But before we do, I want to mention to folks that today's episode is brought to you by Guardian Nation. And I'll have a message for you about that a little further after the meat of the episode. But before we get into the topic on, you know, what to do with a gun after we've, you know, used it, after it's come out of a holster, Matthew, one of the reasons I was inspired to reach out to you this week and see if you were available to come on the podcast is because you live near the Columbus, Ohio area. Is that right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I live in Columbus. So, I'm from Ohio State University, the campus itself, like maybe 10 minutes.
Oh, wow. I didn't even realize you were quite that close.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, and we're talking about that because, you know, folks, most of you probably by now have heard about the attack that happened at Ohio State University on Monday, which we mentioned and talked about a little bit in the Monday news episode of the podcast. So, you know, I saw that on the news and instantly reached out to you, Matthew, and said, hey, man, you know, would you come on the podcast and, you know, at least do that a little justice and talk about it a little bit as far as what we think, happened and what's happened since and get your take on it since you're kind of, you know, at ground zero for this.
Yeah, for sure. And thanks for having me. I love being here with you. But yeah, I mean, obviously, Columbus is pretty diverse as far as demographics. And so, you know, Ohio State University reflects that. So there's a lot of diversity there. So, you know, initially when it came out, I guess, what is kind of unclear if it was an active shooter or what it was, what the motives behind it. It initially came out as an active shooter, but afterwards it turned out to be similar to what happened in France with a vehicle being used and then, you know, a bladed weapon, you know, a knife or whatever.
Was it not Ohio State that probably really kind of started that active shooter terminology, I think, to some extent, because they put out on their website and also in their social media feeds, you know, as soon as it came to their attention, the active shooter situation, you know, get to, you know, a secure area, or I can't exactly what, you know, what they said, but they, you know, they, yeah. Or it was a shelter in place is what they actually put out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know Ohio State does, they have a really good program as far as, their response to active shooters. But I think the problem is kind of knee jerk response to the active shooters on campuses is what, like, college police or university police said, hey, we're going to come up with these strategies to stop active shooters. And they kind of just lumped all, you know, incidents, you know, into active shooters. So they, right. I think the default text or default like message it goes out to all the students is, hey, we have, you know, respond with your active shooter protocols or whatever. And so, you know, even though this guy isn't shooting, everybody assumes it's an active shooter because they're saying, hey, we're going into our active shooter protocols and this and that. So I think that's, you know, that's why that, you know, there's that confusion because, and plus, I mean, the guy, the actual person that got shot or the actual, you know, stabbing the guy who was on the rampage, he was shot. He was the only one who was shot. So maybe somebody heard, you know, the gunshots from the police officers and said, hey, somebody's shooting. And
sure.
And so it kind of just gets wound up into this big, you know, they assume, okay, active shooter and shelter in place. But
right. But, well, yeah. And the specifics don't necessarily matter. I mean, what we know is somebody's on campus or you know, it could be a business, it could be a school, it could be whatever. Somebody's there and they're hurting people. So, you know, the what is often talked about in training, particularly training staff people at businesses or schools and or employees or students of those schools is number one. If, you know, pretty much if you know kind of about where something is happening, then and you can get away, you know, run. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's what's, you know, the terminology now is used, you know, run, hide, fight. It's used in that order because it's like, okay, obviously number one and foremost, if I can get away, I should just get away. You know, provided I can do so safely. Secondly, if getting away isn't a possibility, then I need to hide. You know, and so when these protocols go into place, if you're in a classroom environment, you don't know what's going on, you don't know where it's at, you should probably stay in that classroom. And so, you know, lock the doors, turn off the lights, close up the windows, you know, stack stuff up against the door, you know, and then be super, super quiet. And basically, you know, you act like nobody's home. And this is really tough. I know they practice this with my kids at school. And, you know, they have a tough challenge. You know, they got to keep these kids quiet when they run these drills.
Right.
And, because it's imperative that they remain quiet, which I'm sure is just so hard to do, when kids are scared. Mm-hmm. But, then the final thing is if you realize that the running's not working and the hiding's not working, then you fight.
Yeah. And I think that's a huge one.
Don't go down without a fight. You know, I mean, like we talked about in the podcast the other day about this guy in the hotel who jumped at the robbers that had, you know, burst into their hotel room. And Jacob and I were talking about how, you know, it's amazing. You know, he would just leap at them and wrestle for the gun and stuff, you know. He did the right thing. You know, I mean, like you realize that, okay, I'm either going to get shot or hurt, you know, laying here, or I can go out fighting. And honestly, fighting in that kind of situation gives you your best chance when that's your last resort, because sometimes some of these attackers will give up as soon as they realize they've met some resistance. But anyway, so I didn't mean to get sidetracked, but so you mentioned how Ohio State has a really good program in place, some really excellent, you know, and really up-to-date current protocols as it relates to dealing with active shooter or similar situations. So that went into place. What else happened?
Well, obviously they have a good police department and good, well-trained officers that, you know what they're doing as well as far as responding to these incidents. So that's another plus. And I know there's a lot of, some issues across the country with having, you know, police on college campuses, and some people are really against that idea. But this is just another example. I mean, you know, the city police are going to be responding to, you know, calls in a big area. And when you have dedicated university police there that are well trained, it's really a matter of life and death. I mean, this response was under 2 minutes, which is unbelievable. You know, that right there is, you know, if you look at what happened in France, the response was much, much longer before they got anybody there with a, you know, a firearm that could stop the guy from hacking people up. And then how many people got injured and killed? I think like 80 or something. You know, much, much different outcome if it takes 4 minutes or 5 minutes to get a cop there or somebody with a gun to stop this maniac from hacking people up.
Yeah. And speaking of the officer that put a stop to this attack, that officer is Alan. You know, I heard on the news and I completely forgot how they pronounced it. Horujko, Horujko or Horuko, maybe the J is silent. I don't know. Who has only been on the Ohio State campus police department since January of 2015. He was actually responding to reports of a nearby gas leak and was not, you know, really too far away. He was just kind of, you know, he's in the vicinity when the attacker on Monday drove his car up onto the curb and into the people, the students there, and then of course jumped out. So literally within like a minute or so, he was able to run over and put an end to this, which, I mean, that was remarkable. And, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned how there's campuses and there's people, students and other supporters that would, you know, have police not be on campus or not have a campus police. And, you know, because of all the crap that's gone on with so many things in the in recent history. But you know, this guy was there and in the area and on campus and able to prevent this attack from getting any, you know, even worse. So he certainly, I mean, he is a hero, but I'm sure if you asked him, he would say, I was just doing my job. Because pretty much any other cop would have, you know, done the same thing, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, we could get into the politics of it, you know, as far as what about, you know, campus carry and, you know, what if, and we did a little bit in our Monday episode of the podcast talking about, you know, I mean, it still took this cop a minute or two to get over there and stop this attack. But somebody right there that is already involved, you know, maybe could have stopped it instantaneously. Maybe.
Right, yeah.
You know, that's not a for sure thing either, but you know, certainly if I was one of these so-called victims, I would have liked to have had my gun on me.
Right. I mean, that's all, and we always kind of try to break it down into time, like how many people could have been saved. But if you're the guy who got stabbed or one of the people that got stabbed and you are fully trained, you're a law-abiding citizen, however you had to keep your gun in your car, I mean, it doesn't matter how long, if it was 10 minutes or 5 minutes or a minute before the officer got there, you got stabbed instantaneously and you would have had the ability to defend yourself had it not been for, you know, some arbitrary line in the sand that says, you know, you can carry over there, but not on this side of the sidewalk. So to me, I mean, that's where it boils down to, like, you know, not politically and not rehashing last week's episode, but to me, I mean, I always put myself in and say, what if that was me being stabbed or my family member being stabbed and you know, they deserve the right to defend themselves. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I don't know.
Absolutely. Yeah. You mentioned something interesting, Matthew, in our show prep for today about a law that is being considered there in the state of Ohio.
Yeah, there's a bill that's been kicked around for a while, and it's actually due, I guess, for debate in some committee actually coming up tomorrow. But it's been a assembly bill that's trying to reverse a lot of these gun-free zones and remove them. Campuses would be one of them. Daycare centers would be another one. You know, non-secured areas of police departments and airports and privately owned airplanes would be ones that right now under Ohio law you cannot carry. But they're trying to repeal those or get them changed to allow that. So, I mean, obviously, if you know, a private business still wanted, you know, post no firearms or no weapons allowed, you know, that'd still be a different issue. But as far as making it a felony to carry on a college campus outright, then it would be changed. With the timing of this, it might see a little bit more momentum, I think, seeing, you know, the importance of having somebody there who's trained with a firearm that can stop a threat. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. You know, and it's, these sort of things, when they happen, for the people involved, they happen so quickly that it'll be difficult for someone involved to completely comprehend or wrap their mind around what's going on. And you talked about the importance of, you know, having somebody there that is trained. That someone doesn't have to be, and this is what the point I'd love to get across to anti-gunners out there and anti-concealed carry people, is, you know, how that person that is willing and able and trained, that has a gun on their person, doesn't have to be a cop. You know,
yeah.
I mean, we can put trust and faith in our own people, in our fellow Americans that meet the requirements, that are legal, law-abiding citizens, and you know, in the case of most states, have gone through the requisite training, we can put that trust in them. You know, I mean, that's why we do it. So I'm glad to see that Ohio is hopefully in some areas trying to make it easier for people to defend themselves. I hope to see some of that go through. We talked about recently in Monday's episode too about other states like Alabama and, or maybe it was Arkansas. Yeah. And then also South Dakota that are, and then recently also to Texas, you know, all states that are looking at, you know, making it easier to, you know, live your Second Amendment rights, to have those be a part of your life and, you know, more active part. So, you know, as we mentioned also on the Monday episode, our hearts and prayers go out to those in Columbus, Ohio, and those that were affected by this attack, to the students and faculty of Ohio State. I mean, certainly this is unnerving to anybody, you know, anytime this sort of thing happens. So, you know, we hope there is a quick resolution and recovery, you know, whatever recovery that may be. We hope that that is able to take place, healing. Right. So, Matthew, you know, keep us apprised of things. Like I said, I didn't realize that was, you know, kind of close to home for you. I mean, 10 minutes away, that's not far at all.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Columbus isn't too big. So, you know, we're not too far outside of the city. So pretty much, you know, Columbus is right. Columbus State University is right in the middle of the city. So,
Yeah. Well, good. Appreciate the updates and your perspective on all that. So let's get into now what we really came here to talk about today, which is, you know, I introduced it as being now what? Dealing with the gun after it's been used. And really the inspiration for this came from your article, Matthew, that you wrote, maybe just a little less than a month ago. As I look at it, it looks like November 1st. So pretty recent. You wrote this article that is titled My Controversial Stance on Reholstering. And I like this. I like this article. It's not terribly long. So, folks, if you haven't read it already, it wouldn't take you long to go through and read it. But, of course, we're going to talk about a lot of it right here on the podcast here today. So, you know, we've had an incident. We've had to draw that gun. Now, whether you had need to actually fire and use that, you know, deadly force, or if you just drew the gun and the situation was resolved, your attacker or whatever, you know, withdrew or backed off or gave up because now they realized that they were not attacking just any ordinary old, you know, victim. So regardless of whether a gun's actually or a shot is actually fired, the gun has come out of the holster for some reason, which, just as a reminder for people, in case it's not clear, our guns, you know, that we're carrying on our person, that we're carrying concealed or whatever, should not come out of the holster unless we have really good reason. And and by really good reason, I mean we have reason to use deadly force, right? A gun should remain in the holster unless I might have a reason to actually, like, I actually have to use this gun potentially here in the next, you know, seconds. So regardless of the situation, the gun's come out of the holster. What's the premise for the rest of this article and set us up for our discussion here today, Matthew?
Yeah. I wrote the article, because I get a lot of questions in class, and especially because part of my concealed carry class, we talk about dealing with holsters. And I get a lot of questions about, well, how can I reholster, or, you know, in some of my advanced classes, we talk about coming out of the holster and getting shots on target. But you know, they say, well, why are we not spending equal amount of time talking about and training to reholster? And I say, you know, there's a couple issues, you know, and so I've heard students or, other instructors just talking to them about, them saying, well, you need to be able to reholster your weapon without being, you know, your firearm, without looking at it, without looking at your holster, without looking down and keeping your eyes on the threat. And for me, I, you know, coming from a law enforcement background, I totally, we trained that and I totally understood it because, you know, there are times that you you pull out your firearm on a, you know, a hot stop or a high risk pedestrian stop or a vehicle stop, and you pull out your firearm, and then that person gets out of the car or starts to charge you, and you don't have, you know, articulable facts to be able to shoot this person and use deadly force, you have to transition to another force option. In those situations, yeah, you definitely have to be able to holster that firearm without looking and move to, you know, using your baton or taser or going hands-on or whatever it might be. But like you said, most of the time as a civilian, as a concealed carrier, when you pull your firearm out, it's either the last resort. You're not pulling it out as a magic wand to stop the situation or de-escalate it. You're pulling it out because, you know, you're going to be justified in using it. Whether or not you use it or not is irrelevant. So you're not going to be, you know, de-escalating to a different force option. And most of the time as a concealed carrier, you're carrying either inside the waistband or under clothing. So the ability to get that gun back in the holster is much more difficult when you're talking about an inside the waistband holster underneath clothing, as opposed to an officer who has a outside the waistband, you know, outside holster that's, you know, an inch off his body or her body, and that, you know, can holster that thing. So, you know, I think we're kind of, I wanted to address the whole idea of not looking down at your holster as a concealed carrier to reholster, because for me, I've heard it time and time again, and I didn't think that it applied directly to concealed carry for a civilian.
Yeah. So you sum that up pretty good, or you at least intro it for us pretty well. And I like that you presented both kind of perspectives on this, because, you know, here's what I sometimes wonder, Matthew. You know, you're looking to some sort of holster online or something. You know, you're reading reviews or maybe comments made in some forum somewhere, and you know, you see the comments come up. Well, you know, how good is that holster with reholstering? You know, and somebody might say, well, you know, it's not very good. You know, like that, this would be said about a leather holster, you know, a holster that's completely just formed and made from whether it's cowhide or horsehide, which is another popular option. You know, the supposed problem or challenge with all leather holster is that it would, you know, collapse, unless it had metal reinforcing inside of it somehow or something, you know, then you'd pull the gun out, and when you go back, it would be collapsed and you wouldn't be able to reholster. So sometimes we see these comments, well, you know, you can't reholster with this because it collapses upon, you know, drawing your gun out of it or whatever. And so you see that. And I sometimes wonder if those comments kind of originate or come from law enforcement. You know, the law enforcement community, right? You know, because that certainly is a large community that purchases a lot of gun related products and accessories and holsters and things, and they're going to be interested in gun accessories and holsters and products, and so there's going to be some chatter, some discussion, and a law enforcement officer, like you pointed out, might very well have need, even if he's off duty, you know, and he's carrying off duty, or maybe he's undercover. Or he's a detective, or, you know, he's not wearing a traditional uniform and duty belt with, you know, drop down, you know, holster and all this stuff, you know, like, you know, so I sometimes wonder if the general, you know, gun community and concealed carry community starts getting these ideas in their head that, you know, the holster has got to meet certain criteria. And one of those criteria would be, you know, I have to be able to reholster and do so quickly. And I've got to be able to do it without looking at my holster. And I sometimes just wonder, that's all I'm saying here, is if that has, you know, come from them seeing where a law enforcement officer somewhere else has posted, well, I couldn't reholster, so I didn't like this holster. And I could be, you know, totally, you know, off base on that, but I just sometimes I wonder that. But you presented both ideas or perspectives. You've been a law enforcement officer in the past, and part of your career has been doing that. And so you understand that perspective. Now today, you pretty much are just a civilian. You know, you're raising your daughter and stuff. And so civilian perspective is different than law enforcement perspective when it comes to these sorts of issues. Sometimes the rules are similar as far as the use of force. I mean, an officer can't usually just, you know, shoot somebody because he feels like it. I mean, like you said something really good, by the way. You said how if you, it's a high risk stop, you know, like you just pulled somebody over that you suspect is a wanted felon. You suspect they've stolen this car, whatever. Right. And have you been involved in any stops like that before? I'm just curious.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, you don't know what to expect in those situations. Right. And ideally you're going to hopefully wait for some backup. Right.
Right, exactly. That's normally protocol.
Right, right. I mean, you've got a high risk, a potential high risk situation. You'd rather not handle it yourself. So you know, you get on the radio. You're like, hey, you know, I need some help over here. You know, hopefully there's another officer in the area. They get there, and hopefully you handle it, you know, just fine. But you know, there might be a situation where, like you described, you know, you've come out of the car because for some reason you need to, or even if you've got, you know, backup, a second officer, a cover officer, it doesn't really matter, but you've got your gun out because you don't know what to expect. And you know, this person might be violent and then they start coming at you. And the thing you said that I thought was so great was that, and you don't have, I don't remember exactly how you phrased it, but you can't articulate exactly how, you know, you can use deadly force. Like the situation doesn't warrant that. That's really key. Right. I think that's something that whether you're a law enforcement officer or a civilian that you can take away from what you said is that anytime that we are going to, particularly as a civilian, even draw our gun, but for anybody involved, anytime we're going to use a gun, fire a gun, or think that we might fire a gun, we need to be able to articulate very clearly why. Do you agree with that?
I mean, completely. Because once you know, and once you pull that gun out of the holster, and I always say, you know, don't. It's not meant to intimidate people, or it's not. It's, you know, brandishing your gun isn't necessarily going to de-escalate the situation. It might escalate the situation, but once you take that gun out of the holster, if you don't have articulable facts, or if you don't have justification to shoot this person. Now you're going to, and they want to fight you. Let's say, you know, they're crazy or high, or they just don't care about being shot because they've been shot before, or they don't think that you have the guts to do it. And now you have to fight this person. You're either doing it with one hand, or, you know, you're going to have to reholster this in an inside the waistband holster or do something with that gun. And it's just, it's not a place you want to be fighting somebody with a gun in your hand.
But once again, just so it's clear, like we're really talking about a law enforcement situation there for the most part.
Right.
Because as a civilian, really, I mean, law enforcement has rules in place and policies and even laws, which may vary somewhat from state to state, but there's also constitutional things at play. But law enforcement officers may at times draw and have their gun out or even pointed at an individual, even though there is not a need to actually, you know, to use deadly force. It can be drawn and used in situations to, you know, because the need to use force, deadly force, could happen very quickly.
You know,
and so that's a different world than for, you know, most civilians out there. And so for us civilians now, and I play both sides of the fence now too, because, you know, I'm really primarily and foremost a civilian, but I, in a part-time capacity, do give of my services in a law enforcement type job. And so I see both sides, but when I'm not a full-fledged, you know, officer. You know, I'm not, you know, I'm doing this every day. I'm not, you know, I'm not necessarily really on. I mean, I am on duty when I'm on duty, but I'm pretty much 90% of the time off duty, right? I'm a civilian 90% of the time. And when I am off duty and I'm not carrying cuffs with me, by the way, I'm not carrying a baton, I'm not carrying anything else. You know, I've got my hands, I got a knife, I got a gun. And if I've, for some reason, feel I gotta use a gun, it's because I have a really dang good reason to use a gun. And it means that my life is, this, you know, my life is in danger, or the life of a loved one or something like that. This could even be true, though, in a home, which in a home in many states with castle doctrine laws, you might have a little bit more leeway. I mean, as far as you don't necessarily have to have in many states, I mean, including like in Colorado here, Matthew, I'm sure you can articulate very clearly the law in Ohio, but like in Colorado inside a home, there's not really necessarily anything that prohibits me from having my gun, you know, with me and in my hand as I'm, you know, in my own home. But as it relates to using it on somebody that's in my home, you know, if they have made unlawful entry into the home, if they've committed a crime in addition to the unlawful entry or uninvited entry into the home, and then also, and it has to be also this, if I, as the occupant or any occupant, has reasonable belief that the intruder might use physical force, no matter how slight, against any occupant, then I can use deadly force if I feel the need to, which is a much, much lower standard as far as, you know, as soon as I step outside my front door, the rules completely change and a firearm really becomes, you know, last resort. See, in the home in Colorado, a firearm, you know, the use of deadly force is not necessarily last resort. I would still argue that it probably should be, but once you're outside your home, like it has to be pretty much. So that's a little different for a civilian than it, you know, as it is, it's different in the law enforcement world. So the question then comes up, Matthew, as a civilian concealed carrier, do you have a need to reholster a weapon that you, you know, in general and that you can see?
Well, I mean, obviously we're talking about, we can't cover every or anticipate every single incidence of, you know, or incident of you drawing your right. firearm. But I think it's safe to say as a civilian, 99% of the chance, or 99.9% of the chances of a civilian, you know, drawing their firearm on a threat, the speed is not getting, the need for speed is not getting it back in the holster. The need for speed is stopping that threat and getting to either a position of, you know, advantage where you're safe, where, you know, either the suspect stopped or that person stopped their attack, or you're physically, you know, barrier in between where they can no longer attack you. But it is not getting that gun back into the holster very quickly. Just, I mean, I think, you know, even though people open carry, majority of the people, you know, carry concealed, and even your Kydex holsters, your all Kydex holsters and things like that, you know, they don't collapse, but you know, that might not be comfortable for you. Right. Yep. And so there, you might be carrying on an ankle, you might be carrying, you know, it's not preferable, but as a woman, you might be carrying in a purse, you might be carrying in a shoulder holster, whatever it is. There's so many different other ways to carry. And I think your thought process should not now be, I need to get my gun back in the holster. Yeah. Your thought process should be, once you either stop that threat, would be, let me get to a position of advantage where I can see what's going on with this guy or gal. He's either incapacitated on the ground, or I'm moved to a position where they can no longer attack me with this knife, but I can still see them. Something like that. But it shouldn't be fight's over, let me holster my gun and everything and call it a day, you know?
Let me play a little devil's advocate here. You know, one thing that would be said about this is, well, you know, I need to put my gun away because law enforcement is showing up to the scene, or they're on their way, and I don't want to be the one standing there with my gun outstretched, you know, and I end up drawing fire as they show up to the scene. Like, and
it's fair total point. Valid. Totally valid. And a lot of off duty, I mean, even off duty or detectives, there's an issue with sometimes them getting shot if they're not communicating with the uniformed personnel that are responding to a scene or something, if they've been involved in a shooting. So it is very important. My response to that is that, you know, there are things that you can do besides holstering that can still keep you safe from responding law enforcement. And that's, if you're not going to make the call, you know, direct somebody around you to make the call to 911 and give your description to them.
Yeah.
Tell the person who's calling, hey, I'm a, you know, white male. I'm wearing a blue shirt and blue, brown shorts. Tell them, I'm a concealed carrier and the suspect isn't completely eliminated. So I'm going to keep my gun out. But as soon as the law enforcement arrives, I'll follow any of their commands. Or if you're making the call, let them know the same information. And that way they know, hey, we have a concealed carrier on scene. This is what he looks like. And they'll tell the responding officers that, and, it really helps the situation a lot. You can also, there's certain ways that you can hold your firearm that is not a, necessarily threatening manner. Mm-hmm. So, police aren't going to, even if there's an incident, cops responding to a shooting, they're not just going to come on scene. Hopefully. I mean, most likely they're not just going to come on scene and just start shooting anybody that they see with a gun. They're not trained that way. They're trained to say, okay, I see somebody with a gun, I'm going to give them commands to drop the gun or start giving them commands. If they now don't cooperate or they're not compliant, now it's a different story. But, they're not just going to show up on scene and say, I see a person with a gun, let me shoot him because, we had a shooting. They're still responding and they're still going to approach that scene just like anything else. So it's a valid point. You don't want to be mistaken as the threat. And that's why, giving that information out, holding your gun at a low ready position, towards a threat, is definitely a good, it doesn't look threatening, towards the police. You could even put your hand, your offhand up if the police are arriving and you make yourself seen, somebody who's there to do harm or ambush police aren't going to try to make themselves seen. So, hold your hand up and say, hey, I'm the concealed carrier. I'm the concealed carrier. Give me your commands and whatever they tell you to do, but, it's a valid point, but I don't think you do yourself any favors by quickly getting in the holster, because of that.
Yeah. Like you said, it is a valid point, but it's one that people, I think, tend to freak out about unnecessarily, because you said some things there, I think, that I would have said as well, as far as, officers aren't just going to show up on the scene and without saying anything, without giving commands, just start shooting. Unless as they're showing up on scene, you turn towards them with the gun pointing at them, and that would be the one thing. Like, so you just dropped somebody, to the ground in on your front lawn, let's just suppose. And it was justified shooting or whatever, and you've called 911 and police are showing up. Like, don't, no matter what you do, don't point that gun in their direction at all.
And
assuming you still have it out, which, I would actually say in a lot of cases, go ahead and leave it out. And I'll explain why a little bit further here in a second. And I've talked on this a little bit too in past podcast episodes, but as soon as law enforcement is on the scene, then whatever they tell you to do, like, do it and do it, be ready. This would be part of your mental preparation. You've just had a shooting, a justified, deadly force shooting, and you need to be mentally prepared that as soon as, you might not want to put your gun away because this person might still potentially pose a threat to you. Like, even if they don't look like they might pose a threat to you, they could still very well pose a threat to you. Law enforcement officers that just shot some bad dude, except for in rare situations, like, if they're by themselves and they just shot somebody, like, they don't usually put their gun away and start going hands-on this guy and start getting cuffs on him. They usually will wait until a cover officer gets there.
Right. And then, you'll get a team together and you'll go up and actually handcuff. And once the person is totally incapacitated, then, the scene is safe.
Right.
But criminals oftentimes carry more than one weapon, whether it's a knife, a gun, And oftentimes they're not alone. You know, there could be somebody else with them. So, you know, sometimes we get the tunnel vision. We say, okay, we dropped this person. They had a knife in their hand. There's no way that they could possibly have, you know, a gun, or there's no way that they could actually have somebody else with them. And then somebody, you know, plows through the crowd with a car or something, or, you know, somebody's working in tandem with them. So, you know, that's why initially, you know, and this goes into a whole nother story about, do you render first aid to the person you just shot and everything? But, you know, you don't know that person unless you had a headshot and you can pretty much see, you know, space, you know, through their head, you know, and you see light on the other side and they're not going to be moving. You really don't know if this person is going to become a threat again. And for you to assume that person that you just used deadly force on is no longer a threat without knowing for sure and holstering your gun puts you right back into a situation where, you know, you've already identified them as a threat. Why are you, you know, without them being either in handcuffs or a police officer, you know, having a gun on them, why are you assuming that they're no longer a threat? And that's, you know, I think comes to a training issue, more than anything.
And that's, you know, I personally got a little bit sidetracked there as I was starting to explain, you know, like how to handle a situation as law enforcement are showing up. But, you know, because it's important that we describe, you know, why wouldn't you want to go back to a holster? And that's exactly right. I mean, let me approach this from another perspective as well. And, you know, just being familiar with some, you know, officer-involved shootings, you know, officers have just shot some dude, right? And maybe EMS is able to get there very quickly. You know, cops don't just let EMS, you know, responders run right up to this person and start administering aid until they've made that scene secure, like you described.
Right.
You know, like,
and
EMS sometimes are known for like, I'm not getting near that dude. You know, make sure that he's, you know.
Right. They'll stage around the block before and make sure it's clear before
exactly.
They enter.
And so, like, it should be the same. You know, there's a reason why law enforcement and other EMS folks, even with fire, okay, even in a case of if there's a fire that's got to be put out for some crazy reason, but there was also a deadly force, you know, or some sort of use of force in a situation, like they're going to make sure, like, that's law enforcement's job. Once the situation's under control, is to now make sure the scene is secure for everybody else that's got to come in to do what they've got to do. And the same should be true for each of us as civilians. You know, like, too often I think folks are, they're, you know, okay, gun comes out, bang, 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 bang. They use the gun. They're like, oh, right back to the holster. I don't understand that. And it, clearly, you know, you're not giving enough. If that's you, you're not giving enough thought to just how easily that person, even though you think that you have eliminated them as a threat, it does not guarantee that, and far from it. In fact, did you see the video, Matthew? See, we talked about it in the Monday podcast. I shared a link to a YouTube video of this shooting that happened in Brazil on Thanksgiving Day. Did you see that by chance?
Yes, right? I did.
This was the Brazilian cop off duty going to a jewelry store with his wife, and as they're waiting outside the entrance, two armed thugs approach them, one of them with a gun out already, hammer cocked back, you know, and basically they're robbing them, right? And the off-duty cop, I mean, he just sort of slyly reaches back, you know, he kind of gets his shirt up out of the way and draws his gun. And before this thug even knows what's happening, you know, shots are ringing out. And using that as an example, I talked about a lot of different things in the Monday podcast about that. But going back to that even now, if you watch that video all the way through, now granted, it doesn't continue for a long time after the incident, but that guy, that dude doesn't put his gun away, right? He drops that down the stairs, and that guy, honestly, I mean, even though it's not a very clear, you know, it's a pixelated, you know, blurred video, but he looks like he's out of the fight. You know, he just collapses at the bottom of the stairs. There was a second suspect, right? But that cop, he never puts his gun away. It's out. And he goes down the stairs, he looks around the corner, and, you know, and he's kind of checking things out. He's making sure that, hey, you know, that dude could come back. You know, I could still have another threat here. And he's also keeping an eye, and he checks a little bit on the dude at the bottom of the stairs. If anything, I think he kind of just checks on him just so he can make sure he can peek around the corner and make sure that, you know, his buddy's not coming back at him. But, you know, just using even that as an example, how this officer, you know, the gun comes out, and within seconds, this incident is over, but he still has his gun in his hand. He's making sure that he's still maintaining, you know, security for him, and especially for his wife in that incident. So, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, and I wanted to add something because, you know, you're exactly right. It comes down to, you know, he's a law enforcement officer. He goes through a little bit of different types of training than, you know, your average civilian. However, I think it's important. I know we talked about this way back in about searching and assessing, running drills, multi-target drills, and going searching and assessing, right? And people just kind of wave the gun back and forth. They're not actually assessing the targets. And I think this goes into your training as far as getting back in the holster as well, because if your idea is, I'm going to run a drill of 3 shots, and that drill is over, and once the drill is over, my gun either goes back on the bench that it's in front, and, you know, it's in front of me, or I put it in my holster or whatever, or I bring it down to my side. You're building in those muscle memory. And we talked, you know, you had the podcast about muscle memory. You're building in that muscle memory that I shoot whatever the drill is, or maybe it's 3 shots. I shoot the subject. They drop down to the ground. I shot 3 shots. Now the drill is over, or now this threat is over. What do I do with my gun? There's no bench there. Mm-hmm. They're not used to actually, you know, walking with a loaded gun or holding it in, you know, a low ready position and moving to a place of advantage. So what do? They resort to, I go back in my holster, or I hold it, you know. So it's not, it's a training, it's a mindset that, you know, you're kind of programming yourself to shoot a certain number of shots, or, you know, once this initial threat is done, then the whole drill is done. And, you know, on the range, that's okay. When you're in real life, the drill is not over until either law enforcement arrives or, you know, technically until law enforcement arrives, because they can secure the scene. You can't, secure the scene. So until that scene is secure, so the drill isn't over. And that's why I think, you know, it's a training issue in trying to get out of the mindset of a set number of shots, 2 to the chest, 1 to the head, or whatever your drills are. And mixing it up and running different drills and getting out of that mindset of, once it's over, once I shoot those initial shots, then, oh, now I can holster, everything's done. Because we see it time and time again. It's not done until the scene is totally secure.
Yep. Yeah. I really like that you added there too, talking about, you know, maybe the reason why people are so anxious to get back to holsters, they don't know what else to do with the gun. What can we do with a gun in our hand as we are, you know, we're leaving the gun out, but we don't want to be muzzling anybody unnecessarily. We don't want to, you know, have a negligent discharge or anything like that. So, I mean, what do? Well, finger straight, you know, maintain it at a low ready, you know, down at the ground, right? Where there's not anybody there. If you had to, you know, if for some reason down is not an option, well, you could, you know, have it at a high ready, you know, pointing up. I mean, all that's not, you know, probably not as preferable in a lot of situations, but I mean, you just have your finger off the trigger and be pointing in a safe direction. You know, it's not that complicated, and maintain it there. If you feel the need to, just low ready and wait till cops arrive. I mean, there's been situations too, where civilians have held, thugs, attackers, intruders, you know, held them at gunpoint, you know. Okay, that's fine. Do you have to have it pointed right at their head? No. You can have it just right there, right in front of them. If you know, it doesn't take you more than quarter of a second to move 5 inches and put it on them and pull the trigger again if you really, you know, wanted to or had to. So a low ready, finger off the trigger, not complicated at all. And you can wait there all day long. Now, so kind of back to where I was a few minutes ago, you know, what do you do? How do you handle it when law enforcement show up and maybe you still have a gun out? And, you know, people are a lot of times concerned about that. They're worried about that. They're worried how that would play out. Well, let me describe it for you. And I've described it before, but in case you've missed it, I've watched a number of videos through the years and seen situations play out and read about them and talked with officers that have responded to them. And the fact is, as we described a little while ago, cops aren't going to show up on the scene and just start firing shots because they see some dude with a gun. So going back to what I was saying about mental preparation, like part of your mental preparation should be, you know, being ready for law enforcement to show up. And along with that is as soon as they show up and they say, you know, drop the weapon, you know, get down on the ground or whatever it is they tell you to do, like you do it and you are ready to do it immediately. Now, sometimes the question comes up, what if I can't understand what that officer's yelling at me? Right? I just went through a traumatic experience. Maybe I'm not hearing things well. Maybe I'm whatever it is. Okay. Then by all means, play it safe. You know, cops show up and their guns are drawn and they're yelling at you. Well, put, you know, slowly without pointing a gun or even moving their direction at all, set your gun down. You know, hands up in the air. And by the way, your support hand in all cases, I would say, you know, even if you have your gun trained on a bad guy, and cops are showing up, take your support hand off the gun and raise it in the air. Like, hi, this is me. Hello, help me, please. Right? Like, that's just kind of a standard sign. And then, and as you keep that support hand in the air, you know, instead of having a full grip with finger by the trigger and everything on the gun, kind of pinch it between your index finger and your thumb in a very non-threatening way. You know, like it's a stinky sock or something, you know, switch over and just kind of pinch the gun in your hand because that's very non-threatening, right? It's hard for somebody with one hand, you know, with them pinching it in between their index finger and their thumb to all of a sudden switch that quickly, you know, into a full grip and start pointing it at cops and pulling the trigger and getting accurate shots. Like it just doesn't happen. So, you know, handle it in a very non-threatening way, support hand in the air, slowly without going anywhere near or towards the officers, pinch it between the fingers and put it on the ground. That is not hard to do at all. And guess what? It happens all the time and nobody gets shot for it. And also I will point to the instances where there's a guy a number of years ago that stopped a carjacking incident, you know, of himself. He was getting carjacked. He draws his weapon and holds this guy, you know, at bay with his gun drawn. Law enforcement show up on the scene. He raises his hand at them, kind of waves at him like, oh, hey, I'm over here. And they come up and they just like practically ignore him. They look at him. They're like, is this the guy? And he's like, yep.
Right.
And then they don't care that he's got the gun in his hand. Like he even looks confused at one point. He's like, maybe I should put this down. You know, there was an incident, the guy at the church who's got his gun drawn, holding, you know, guy's got like a crowbar or something in his hand. And, you know, he's like, you know, you wait here. I don't know who you are. You're scaring me. You've got a weapon. You know, he's got his gun out and cops show up. And they show up and they like practically ignore the citizen, the, you know, do-gooder. And he kind of like starts sort of backing off and slowly wandering, you know, off to the side. And he's just kind of like, you know, I don't even think they said anything to him in that incident. They're just like, oh, that's the bad guy. Cuffs on him. And, you know, the gun owner is like, So, I mean, like, I mean, not to say that that's going to be how it is always, but I mean, certainly in the worst case scenario, when a law enforcement show up there, I have no problem personally with me having my gun out at the, you know, low ready because I just had an altercation with somebody that was violent and I don't know what the heck, you know, they might else do to me or their buddy that's watching from around the corner, you know, or whatever. And I'm just going to have my gun there. And when they show up, I'm going to raise one hand and I'm going to listen for instructions. And I am not worried about getting shot. So, you know, this question of, well, I got to get back in the holster before they show up. I mean, if you're able to do that and you're able to do it safely, fine. Okay. I don't have a problem with that. If provided there's no longer a legitimate, like, you know, for a fact, maybe because the guy that attacked you has run off. Now, could he come back? Well, yeah, he could. But let's just say you are completely confident that there is no more risk to you. Fine, reholster your gun. But otherwise, there's, in my opinion, absolutely no need to. So this, you know, Matthew, you wrote this article, and you said that people, And instructors will tell students that you got to be able to reholster your firearm without looking at your holster. You got to, you know, and you can't look down while reholstering because you got to keep your eyes on the threat. Now, there might be some truth to that, but particularly in the law enforcement, you know, side of things. But, you know, as we've already covered, but for all you civilians out there, listen to what we're saying here and just trust me on this. You don't need to be as concerned about this as what you think or what you've been told. If you had any sort of law enforcement training at all. Now, a little caveat here, because we had Alex Rogulski in our monthly live broadcast last month. I don't know if you saw that, Matthew.
Cool. I did. I caught
part of it, yeah.
And he actually
says, hey, I'd recommend you, you know, reholster and stuff after you've made sure that it's safe. Yeah, that's his opinion. That's fine. You know, like, and I think that was the point. It was like, okay, if you're certain that there's no longer a threat or a risk to you or your loved ones or whatever, then yeah, get back in the holster. All right. But take it, you know, take it from myself and Matthew, who certainly has, you know, way more patrol and on, you know, on the streets experience than I have, that if you just had to be involved with somebody where you, your gun came out of the holster, then you're not going back to the holster unless you've got a cover officer or you have really, you know, other good reason. So
yeah, I mean, the best way I can say it is if you are so worried about this threat that you cannot take your eyes off them, then there's no way that you should be trying to reholster that gun. True. You just shouldn't. If you can put your gun away, then that means to me that you've assessed the situation and you say, I have zero threat level. I can go back in my holster, and at that point, you can take as much time as you want. You know, you're not in a race with anybody if there's no threat. So, you know, it's not a race to get back in the holster, especially if you have a soft holster that collapses when you draw the gun out. Now, think about this: you've just been involved in a shooting. Your adrenaline's going to be pumping. We all know what happens with gross motor skills and everything like that. And now you are trying to reholster your gun quickly and get it back in an inside the waistband holster that might have just collapsed on you or even didn't collapse on you, but just trying to get it back in the holster. You know, that's not the place where you want to be when you have every opportunity to pause that situation, let the your adrenaline kind of drain out a little bit, let the situation kind of return to normal where you can now, you know, calmly reholster. People, you know, it's just for me, you know, and you mentioned it in the comments, and I definitely wanted to address it because, you know, I can reholster without looking at the holster. It's, you know, and I do practice that, but it's not because I'm trying to get back in the holster and I wouldn't do that. I do that because it's part of my training that I've gone through since, you know, being a cop and everything is, you know, when you practice drawing out of your holster, your body kind of naturally knows how to reverse that process. So, you know, you will be able to, with training, to get that back in the holster without looking. But, you know, I personally just don't see it. I don't see a benefit into trying to jam a loaded firearm in your, you know, in a soft holster or in any inside the waistband holster, you know, after you just been involved in a high stress incident. It just doesn't make sense to me. It just, the risks don't outweigh the reward, I guess, or the reward doesn't outweigh the risks.
Right. Let me play out just real quick. And so for people's minds, kind of how, you know, I do some law enforcement training. I'm a post-certified handgun and patrol rifle instructor. And so, you know, we work with our officers and train them. And one thing that we're training, you referenced earlier, was, you know, searching or scanning, right? You're looking for other threats, looking for things around you, stuff like that. Let me describe to you, like, one thing that we're always trying to get into our officers' heads, you know, is, okay, let's suppose that you just had need to use force. You drew your gun, you fired it. And let's suppose that for whatever reason, you know, you're shooting from a prone position, right? Which is, you know, when might you need to do that? Well, maybe you're using the vehicle and a wheel and a tire as your cover, and you're kind of you're prone and you're leaning out and around that wheel and tire and shooting from underneath the car. Absolutely, you know, plausible. Okay, let's say you've just done that. You've got a cover officer. Okay, so you got a buddy backing you up, and he says, "All right, you know," he's like, "I got it. You know, you go ahead and go up there," and he's like, "I'll cover you, and you're going to go put the cuffs on this guy, right?" So meanwhile, you're down on the ground, prone. All right. So some people would be inclined that, "Oh, I got to jump up and now go, you know, secure this individual while my cover officer is backing me up." And I promise you, if you took a rookie or you took somebody that's got, you know, it's their first day in the academy or anything like that, and you're like, you know, they're prone and they were just shooting, and you're like, "Now, you know, go get cuffs on this guy," a lot of people will have a tendency to go right back to the holster, even right there in the prone position, jump up and run over there and do the job. But what do we teach? Mm-hmm. You're down there prone, okay? You're going to actually, as best as you can, scan around you before you get up from prone. All right? Okay. I don't see anything. I don't see any of the threats. All right? I'm going to get up now to a more of a kneeling position. You get up, and you're going to scan again. All right? No more threats. Nothing going on. Then you're going to get up maybe to a standing position and scan one more time before you come back and hesitantly, because you're in no hurry to, put your gun back in the holster. You know, like that's kind of like, that's sort of the mindset or the process we go through trying to teach, you know, so we get it into them that, look, before you do anything, you know, like you just had to fire shots, you need to make sure that you're not putting yourself at risk by putting a gun away, which then if something came up, now you got to get back out, you know? Like, you are absolutely very hesitant to get back to that holster. Unless, like you said, I mean, you can't talk about every potential situation that could occur. You know, maybe there is a reason you got to get this guy wrestled to the ground and cuffs on him, you know, because he's wounded, but he's trying to run away now. All right, I got to go tackle him, you know, whatever. But you just shot somebody, he's down the ground, he's not moving, and you know, like you're going to go through that very methodically. It doesn't take necessarily a long time, but you're going to search, scan, okay, get up, search, scan, okay, get up, search and scan, okay, now I'm going to go back to the holster sort of thing. I mean, that's the ideal. And that's, we try to impress that on, you know, guys in our agency so they don't make a mistake. That's what we're trying to avoid here, is making mistakes. And have cops and other people been killed because, you know, they were hasty in making a decision, you know, doing something too quickly or without thinking or without being aware of what was around them? Yeah, it has happened and does happen. And so fortunately with experience, you know, and you know, we got guys that have been able to, you know, train you, Matthew, and train myself and say, look, you know, there's reasons why we do things the way we do them. And a lot of that does have still application to the civilian world as well. So I don't know if you agree or disagree with, you know, some of what I described there, but
I totally agree. I mean, spot on. I just, you know, we make mistakes when we try to rush and try to do things too quickly. And if you have the ability, I always, you know, training rookies and stuff, I always said, hey, if you have the ability to pause that situation or not rush into a situation, keep time on your side. Yeah. And if you don't have to rush getting back in the holster, then why do it? You know, you're just setting yourself up for the possibility to make a mistake. Yeah, maybe you train getting back in the holster without looking and you can do it in, you know, 10th of a second. I don't know. But why risk that when you don't have to? I mean, getting it out of the holster quickly is important. Getting it back in the holster super fast, you know, on the probability scale is not, you know, is not very high. And I'm not saying you shouldn't be able to do it, but I'm just saying it shouldn't be your priority after you just shot somebody, you know? So.
Yep. So, you know, we've probably beat it to death pretty good. I mean, but there's a lot of things to consider here and take into account. And, you know, I feel we've done it, you know, justice by, you know, really analyzing this whole idea of what do I do with my gun after I just had to use it? And, you know, especially relating to getting back into a holster or not getting back into a holster. And I have one more thought before we kind of move on to our picks of the week and stuff. And I was thinking, you know, of a number of shootings that I've seen, you know, whether it's a, you know, dash cam video or whatever, you know, an officer just got involved and just shot somebody, right? And maybe the parasympathetic response is kicking in and they're kind of starting to go, oh, geez, you know, like understanding and realizing the gravity of what just happened, you know, that which happens, right? And I've seen this play out a number of times where that officer doesn't necessarily always go back to their holster. Maybe their buddy, their partner, a cover officer will come over and sometimes grab them by the arm and say, okay, look, you know, Riley, come on over here. We're going to have you sit down on the curb. Or we're going to have you sit down on the side of the patrol, you know, in the patrol car. And that officer, I mean, I'm sure you've seen this too, where the officer takes their gun from them, right? Because they just had this traumatic experience. Like the expectation is not that you're going to go, you know, you're going to put that back in the holster. I mean, sometimes they might, and they do, but there's plenty of these situations where it's like, you know, the situation's over. Don't be in a rush, you know, don't do something stupid. And because you're so hyped up, you know, you make a mistake and you shoot yourself or you have a negligent discharge. You know, if somebody steps in and says, hey, Riley, let me take that for you. Fine. You know, like that. So that's just another thought to give people to think about. So anyway, really appreciate your thoughts on this. Matthew, do you have any last words? I mean, you were the author of the article after all.
No, you hit it. I mean, you hit everything. I agree with you totally. I see eye to eye with you on this point. Totally.
Cool. And I suspected we would. Of course, you and I had the opportunity to talk ahead of time, and
we kind of
knew what we were doing. So let's get into Picks of the Week. But first, today's episode is brought to you by Guardian Nation. Guardian Nation is the community for devoted gun people focused on guarding themselves, their families, homes, and communities. We hope that you'll check it out and consider joining. Whether it be for the monthly training and drill videos, discounts on products in our store, the monthly Guardian Nation live broadcasts with top industry professionals, or the quarterly box of handpicked Guardian gear, there's something for everyone in becoming a member of Guardian Nation. Check it out now at www.guardiannation.com. That's GuardianNation. GuardianNation.com. Very cool. Your pick of the week, Matthew.
Yeah. So real quick, I have a iPhone, and that's not my pick of the week, but my I do have an app for the iPhone, and I don't know if they have it for Android. I assume that they would, but it's just called Shot Timer, and it's free. And there's a lot of Shot Timer apps that are, you know, you have to pay for them. And obviously buying a Shot Timer, they're kind of expensive. I think, you know, around 90, 100 bucks probably for a decent one. But this app is free and it really allows you to do some cool stuff. It does split time. It does total time. And it's really cool. It's obviously probably, you can adjust the sensitivity depending on what type of caliber you're using and things like that. But I think it's cool. It's probably not something that you could use in a competition setting, but it's definitely for your own sake, getting time hacked on maybe coming out of the holster and getting rounds on target. It'll tell you your first, you know, how long it took you to get your first shot. And then your split time. So it's really good in seeing, you know, hey, how quick am I getting that first shot on target? And then, you know, follow-up shots, which I use in my classes. I use this timer in my classes to get people an idea of, you know, where they stand speed-wise.
Cool. No, that's great. And I have the same app on my phone, actually. And it's not bad. I mean, it's definitely not as good as my, you know, competition electronics, you know.
Right.
whatever the model is that I have, which is, I mean, kind of the standard model, But I've certainly used my Shot Timer app in a pinch. So very good pick, because I hadn't thought to actually ever use that one for myself. So bravo, Matthew Marister. So my pick this week is the Stoeger M3K shotgun. This was a recommended to me a number of months ago as I was considering getting into a three-gun competition. And, you know, there's guys using these, you know, Benellis and you know, Winchester and Remington shotguns as well. And Stoger is kind of a cheaper version of a Benelli. And a guy that I know and I respect, you know, he's been shooting three-gun for years. And he's like, dude, he's like, just go get the Stoger M3K, which is really the M3K is just a special model made with a few modifications already done to it, with, you know, that normally you'd have to do after the fact if you just bought a standard Stoger M3000. That's basically all it is an M3000 Stoger shotgun, semi-automatic, inertia, you know, driven action, similar to the Benellis, because it basically is the Benelli design, but just cheaper. And like I said, the M3K version comes with some three-gun modifications done already. It has an enlarged loading port on the bottom, enlarged charging handle, you know, things of that nature, and is, you know, out of the box, not a bad little shotgun. But I did add to it, and this is my other pick, so I got two because it kind of goes hand in hand, and that is the MOA Precision. I think mine is the Plus 6 magazine extension tube. So,
sweet.
So, you know, it's, I got a long tube on this now, so I can hold 10 plus 1 in the shotgun, which is helpful for those longer stages in competition shooting, in three gun in particular. So that's my pick. It's a great little shotgun. I've shot several hundred rounds, maybe close to 1,000 now through it over the last couple months, and it's performed, you know, admirably well. I've not had any misfeeds, jams, malfunctions, anything like that. And it's pretty much ready to, you know, with the mag extended tube on it, it's pretty much ready to go out of the box, you know, show up to a three gun competition, and you know, it's done me well. So check it out. Coming up next, Matthew, what you got going on?
Well, because I'm out here in Ohio and it's starting to get cold, not as many concealed carry classes going on in the wintertime. Still doing it, but definitely slows down a little bit when there's snow on the ground. So I'm going to be retooling a lot of my concealed carry video material that I have. So that's
cool.
That's going to keep me busy over the winter.
Nice. I like it. And for me, it's kind of similar to a summer yard as far as, like, I got some videos and things I got to work on and some things in the in progress there. Especially, actually, I got to do a video review for DigiTrigger, which was my pick last week at digitrigger.com. Some of you may have gone and checked that out. Really cool hybrid mechanical and digital trigger for AR-15 platform rifles. And I reached out to those guys last week and said, hey, I'd love to get my hands on one and review it and demo it and try it out and do a whole write-up and video and everything. And so supposedly they have shipped one and it's on its way to me. So I'm looking forward to getting that and cool. Doing the review. So that should be coming up here very soon.
Yeah, then that's cool. I'm excited. I'm going to stay tuned for that because that's cool. Yeah. I've been interested in that.
Yeah, yeah. You'll have to check it out. Wish you were closer, you know, and I'd say, hey, you know, meet me at the range and you can see how awesome this thing is. But, yeah, Ohio is just a little ways away.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, that pretty much wraps it up for today. Thanks again, Mr. Marister, for your time and your dedication to our company. I mean, number one, as one of our network and affiliated instructors there in Columbus, Ohio, and also to this podcast. We always appreciate having your voice on.
Oh, man, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. No, thank you. And so, folks, if you haven't already subscribed to the podcast, I mean, we strive to make this positive, uplifting, educational, informative, and still, hopefully, somewhat entertaining program for your listeners. If you haven't done so already, please, you know, we'd hope that you would subscribe. And it's been a while since I mentioned this, so if you have questions or don't know really how to subscribe to the podcast, you can go to usafirearmtraining.com/subscribe-2, that's T-O, dash podcast. And the link is always in the show notes that we post along with the episode on the site. So, you know, definitely encourage you to go subscribe so you don't miss anything. Last week we had big announcements about our Black Friday sale and you know, you wouldn't want to miss out on that. So, we definitely have more things planned and lots of great things coming here at USA Firearm Training. And one of the best ways to hear about it first is right here in the podcast. So thank you all for supporting us, listening. We had a great Black Friday sale and lots of activity there, and we really sincerely do appreciate it. So with that, we're going to say farewell to you all. Matthew?
Yes, sir.
Just your chance to say goodbye.
Oh, well, thank you, Jacob.
Riley.
Whoops. Thanks, Riley. I'm reading something. Thanks, Riley. And next time you'll have Jacob back, so he'll be your regular voice back. So, but I appreciate it.
Yeah,
really, really appreciate it.
And now we're even because you called me Jacob, and I think I called you Jacob before too.
You did.
So now we are even.
But I don't know if that's necessarily an insult. So, you know.
No, not at all. In fact, I'm honored that you would think. Jacob's going to get a kick out of listening to this one. So with that, folks, thanks for listening. We'll bid you farewell till next week, which will be the Monday news episode, which will be in December already. Crazy to believe that today's, by the time you're listening to this, will be the last day of November. So we'll see you next week, December. Monday news episode of the podcast. Take care, be safe, train hard.
A reminder that laws vary from place to place, and we encourage listeners to seek local legal advice to understand applicable laws. USA Firearm Training and the Concealed Carry Podcast strive to share insights and stories about firearm-related incidents and laws, but things could be different where you live, or laws may have changed by the time you listen to this. We cannot be held liable for your actions based on the information shared in the podcast.